Okay. I'll just turn it over to Judy. Right now, we're going to go over the next steps later. Right now, we'll just have the open discussion. Judy's going to facilitate that.
Great. We've put aside an hour of question/discussion. What I'd like to offer you is that for those that have comments and suggestions, this is also a good opportunity for us to hear your suggestions. If you still have clarifying questions or questions about how we're going to do something, you're welcome to do that. But this is also an opportunity for you to provide us your direct input. So if you see something here and you say, "Well, we really think the assumption should be Y," this is an opportunity to do that. At the same time, we will ask you to follow up with a written comment so that we make sure we capture your suggestions in writing as well as what you would like to provide us now. Because of the timing and we're working really hard now, the earlier you can provide us in comments now, we also welcome that. Also, in addition to our request earlier to have the link to some studies that you think would be very valuable for us, we actually are just opening that up for everybody else. If you think there are studies out there that we should consider and we haven't mentioned it and you really think that's very valuable, why reinvent the wheel? Make sure we incorporate those insights. I also welcome to have that now and, of course, also in the written comments. If you could provide us not just a list of all the, 50 studies you think are interesting out there, but also how they're interesting and how you think we ought to make sure we incorporate those insights, that would be very helpful for us. So I just want to open that up. You'll help me to see who else is on the phone, but I'll start in the room here. Yes, sir.
Mike Jaski, California Energy Commission. You may have a good reason for choosing the 2013 IPER, but everyone in the world is going to ask you why you didn't base it on the 2015 IPER. Just keep that in mind.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Travis Ritchie with Sierra Club. I have two questions, actually. The first one, one of the questions that was asked earlier on the phone by Ezra, who was working with us, was how the assumptions are going to interplay with SB 1368 and the kind of the emission performance standard goals of California. I understand that that's an investment-based statute, so it requires how investments can be made going forward, but for instance, if the merger goes forward with PacifiCorp, it wouldn't be subject to that in its non-California states. So how do we see the results in the analysis looking at what the energy mix of California or the power coming into California is going to be? And is it going to be predictive of that? And are there any assumptions that there are going to be legal or regulatory boundaries like what was added to the EIM?
Yeah, that's a good question. My understanding is that we will, as I think, Brewster, you mentioned in your presentation, we are assuming all the policies are in place, and we assume that, the policies will be observed to the extent that it's more about potentially new contracts or new purchases from future resources or resources that will be dispatched differently. I think that we will address in the study. So the emissions impact associated with dispatching resources differently under regional versus standalone case, that we will be capturing. But as far as the existing policies about new resources meeting a certain emission standard, I think we just assume that policy is in place and we will comply with those, regardless of standalone case or WEC-wide case.
And then my second question was, speaking of the WEC-wide versus, I guess I was a little surprised today coming in to realize that this was actually going to be looking only at the WEC-wide as opposed to the current proposal of merging California and PacifiCorp first. And so I guess from a procedural standpoint, I'm having trouble reconciling why we're on a fairly accelerated timeline right now for this proposal, but that the instant question before us, which is what would be the impacts of, in my mind, of Pacific Coast Fleet joining California's fleet, how does that, you know, what are the impacts, positive and negative, from that? It appears to be something that's not going to be addressed in this study. And I wonder if there's any way to either incorporate that and or, you know, lengthen out the time of looking at this so that we can understand that first stepwise question before looking at the region-wide question as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and I think this meeting also highlighted that for us as well. I think, again, in some ways, they're on separate tracks, even though extremely related. The 350 study is, we're really, in some ways, extracting ourselves away from the specific incident in hand intentionally. And to, I think Mark had mentioned earlier, if it informs that PAC integration study, then that will occur. But this, right now, our 350 study is not intended to displace or replace or PAC integration study. Mark?
Yeah, I think that's correct. And as I said earlier, we'll take what we learned either from the assumptions or anything that we need to feedback into the Pacific Core integration analysis, but I don't think the SB 350 intent was to just focus on the Pacific Core integration. I think it was more looking at the regional, the overall regional opportunity or impacts. So it's not like we're ignoring this back on the Pacific Core work. It's just that we will assess what we need to do, if anything, at that point when this is complete. To the other comment, though, I think just to clarify that the dispatch analysis will factor in the cost of carbon to the extent it's being that dispatch is being transferred into California, so it doesn't. It won't neglect that piece of it, and so I just want to make sure that that's clear.
Okay. Just going to give an opportunity for that gentleman back there.
Hello, this is Dave Smith with Transwest Express. I have a suggestion and a question as well. And I'm just going to use my understanding of the Pacific Core benefit study to I think we'll kind of end up in the similar results relative to where the big bang for the benefits are going to come within this study, which is, we found was remote procurement of remote resources really, dwarfed the other benefits savings. So I'm not sure if that's what you're going to find here, but I'm going to base my suggestion on that. With the SB 350 study is looking at regionalization of the ISO. In a different track, I believe it is possible without any change in the California ISO governance to procure out-of-state resources and even build transmission to those. And I'd like to suggest that maybe another case would be remote procurement, but without the regionalization, the SB 350. And in that way, you would understand what benefit would come from regionalization of the markets and what would come from, direct connection to the CalISO, under the existing SB 350 rules. So that's my suggestion. I don't know if that makes sense to the group or not. And then I had a question on deliverability in the regionalization study.
Okay, I think that is clear. And please, as I said during the break, please also include that in your comments.
Yeah, okay, we will. So for the question, Artie, you mentioned that I think you're using the same standard as what my understanding was in the study you did for Pacific Core and ISO on the benefits was around deliverability, either not being required or some kind of market forces coming into play or market transactions coming into play where energy wouldn't have to be delivered to load resources in California. Is that the assumption that the regionalization study is going to be working under, or is there really a need for physical transmission capacity to make these transactions comply with both the bucket, the content categories, as well as the planning process, transmission planning process for the ISO?
I mean, that's a great question, obviously. You know, when we first looked at what this portfolio might look like under Scenario 3, you know, it took a little bit of time, at least for me, to think really about a west-wide transmission entity, a west-wide transmission tariff, and what the transmission might look like under that type of an entity. And my initial assumption was that we might look at building wind in Wyoming and New Mexico with new transmission to California and the regional integration being the catalyst that finally makes that type of investment, you know, really make sense from an institutional point of view. The more that I thought about the question of what it would look like under a true regional transmission organization, the more I came to think about, well, you might not actually need to build that transmission from New Mexico all the way to the California border or from Wyoming all the way to the California border. It may be possible, and I say may because no one's done the transmission studies that really support, you know, this world under this regional transmission organization, but it may be possible to build less transmission and, you know, use those resources to displace thermal resources both in California and throughout the West using much more of the existing grid. And so that's the assumption that we've made in our portfolios to date, is that you might actually be able to integrate these remote wind resources with less transmission investment than would be required to get all the way to the California border, as you would have to do under today's product content categories.
I also want to supplement that answer to say that there are two very important decisions here, right? One is, how does California as a policy allow procurement of resources? And that, I think, is within the control of California policymakers to decide, even under a regional market, where bucket one, you know, what are the requirements of bucket one? Does it have to be physically delivered or not? Those are under the control of the policymakers. The second question is, if the policymakers have decided that first point of interconnection, as long as it's within the balancing area where California resides, if that's the case, then the power does not have to be physically delivered to California. If that's the decision that the policymakers decide, the system just has to be balanced. Obviously, you need to build enough transmission and other resources to balance that on the system, but it doesn't have to be physically balanced by California. And there are many examples like this in the East. So there are significant, for example, renewable portfolio standards in, let's just say, Massachusetts, my home state, has a high renewable requirement. It does not necessarily mean that the wind resources have to be physically delivered to Massachusetts. It just has to be on the ISO New England system. Similarly, in Mid-Continent ISO and Southwest Power Pool, there are states that are procuring resources that are balanced by the pool, so to speak, or by the region. So that, I think that's the idea that we're
trying to get. I agree with what you're saying, and I agree that it might be possible that you don't have to build any more transmission. But I'm also, you know, here in California, my understanding is $6 billion of transmission was built for the 33% renewable within the state. And so when I think through how that came to be and think about the physical or lack of physical capacity in the West, it makes me think that that assumption is very aggressive for this type of study. So we'll put our comments in, but if you take a look at the, you know, the capacity between Wyoming or New Mexico, there's not a lot of transmission capacity.
Well, just let me be clear about what we've assumed so far. It's not that there's no transmission required to be built.
In fact, we've included, I think, $1.5 billion worth of new transmission investments in that scenario three to bring the remote wind resources to market. It's just that the market that we bring them to doesn't have to necessarily be, you know, SB 15 or NP 15, you know, 1,000 miles away all the way over to the coast. So the transmission build is less than it might be if you were assuming that physical delivery requirement. But there definitely is new transmission required in our assumption so far, and I think in reality, to access, you know, of really large quantities of those very high quality New Mexico and Wyoming wind resources.
Kevin
Woodruff, consultant for TURN. I've got a few comments I'll make over the next 45 minutes, but Dave Smith from Transwest Express sort of set up the first one. This goes back to the discussion of the fundamental difference between Scenario 2 and Scenario 3, being new transmission doesn't happen without, you know, a west-wide ISO. A week ago, the ISO put out its draft transmission plan for 2015 to 2016, and I believe it was Transwest Express is a, you know, mentioned by numerical data in here anyway. The conclusion is the ISO considers the submitted project to be an interregional transmission project between NTTG and the ISO, as relevant planning reasons would need to be submitted to the NTTG's and ISO's regional planning process for coordination of the next ISO planning cycle. At that time, the ISO will coordinate with NTTG on the assessment of the submitted project. So the ISO a week ago is saying we have a process for looking at interregional projects, okay? It's not like it's exactly, now hopefully what I've heard today is like you're not saying this is going to fail, this process you're setting up here. But I, you know, that whole notion that new transmission won't happen into California without a regional ISO, it's not correct. Okay, it might be easier, might be much easier, but it's not correct in the absolute, which is how you're modeling it. So
I think your point is
I think your point's well taken, Kevin. We're not saying it's impossible. We're saying it's really, really hard. Okay? And it's really, really hard to do it under the current construct.
Well, this is a new construct. This is FERC 1000.
Yep, that's a planning construct.
Yeah.
You have to get beyond planning to actually get the states to agree to permitting. And absent having a centralized, coordinated planning process that a regional footprint can provide, it's a much more challenging proposition. I agree with you, it's not black and white. So we're violently agreeing on that point. But the question is, you know, given how challenging it is it really credible to put it out there that you could do this absent having a west-wide market? And if you could, I don't want to debate that point with you in the interest of time, but that is the question.
Yeah, and maybe you should take the benefits of that and multiply them by 50% maybe, something like that, some sort of estimate of the advantage. Anyway, my thoughts.
Yes.
Hi, Dave Marcus from Q. On this same subject, let me, as a preamble, say what I understood that I heard earlier today, which is that the Resolve model thinks that there's, in Scenario 3, and only in Scenario 3, a potential for 6,000 megawatts of wind development in New Mexico and Wyoming that's dependent on new transmission, and that in the Resolve results, it actually selects 3,000 megawatts, 1,500 from each, at a cost, I heard Arnie say just now, is $1.5 billion. Did I hear that much correctly? And if so, I'll go on to my question.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's generally correct. And don't quote me for right now on the $1.5 billion, but it's somewhere in that range.
Okay. So the question is, if New Mexico and Wyoming wind is the cheapest resource at the bus bar and is a selected resource even with the transmission costs, why are you only selecting half of it in Scenario 3? Why doesn't Scenario 3 take all of it? Who is the stupid California utility who's passing up cheap stuff to buy more expensive stuff in California?
That's actually a really, really great question. Because, you know, the answer is that it's not necessarily cheapest, it's not necessarily cheaper than California solar at first cost, right? What makes it cheaper on a net value basis is that the output profile is complementary to the California solar. So you really need to get, you know, enough solar in California, far enough up that kind of supply curve in California to where the overgeneration from having, you know, too much solar during certain times of the year becomes such a strong economic factor that it makes the model want to find diverse resources. It really puts a premium on California wind, on geothermal, on Oregon wind, on any resource that doesn't have the same profile as the solar resource. So it finds it economic at right at that 50% RPS level to build those first 3,000 megawatts of high-quality out-of-state wind, but it doesn't find it economic to take that second tranche for which we've assumed higher transmission costs and that to displace the California solar.
So by that same logic, if we were looking earlier in time, you wouldn't take any of the Wyoming wind if you only had a 33% RPS? Is that the sort of thing that's going on? And 50% you take half of it, and maybe a 60% you would take the rest?
Certainly if we were going to 60% and trying to build a lot more solar in California, it would make the economics of this out-of-state wind much, much more attractive. I can't answer the 33% question, but I think there's probably a reason why we haven't seen these resources already in the California portfolio. California solar costs have come down, which, you know, for the next, between 33 and 40%, just to, you know, use an example from a different model, you know, the RPS calculator has many of the same economic factors of valuing the resources built into it. It builds California solar almost exclusively through about 2024. At which point it's so saturated with solar that it builds almost exclusively whatever wind is available to it after that. So it's this kind of dynamic that, you know, really helps to take those out-of-state wind resources, which are very high quality, but do have that transmission requirement, and make them much more economic to fit within the California portfolio because of the diversity.
So isn't that an alternate answer to the one that was offered to me earlier about why Wyoming wind hasn't been developed yet? Which is the economics haven't existed yet and won't exist until 2024, which leads to Kevin's question about who says you can't do Wyoming under scenario one or scenario two.
You know, when we built the first RPS calculator back in 2008, trying to go from 20% RPS to 33% RPS in California, that study showed very clear benefits to Wyoming wind relative to California solar, which at that time was very, very expensive. There's been any number of studies done since then that have had, you know, similar outcomes, including the recent one by NREL. Those dynamics have been out there for a while, and I agree with Keith. I think it's very, very difficult to get that done without some form of regional entity.
Okay, I'd like to move on to the next question.
Mike Jaski, Energy Commission staff. Earlier, like 5 minutes ago, there was use of the word deliverable, and I guess I'm wondering how formal people are using that word. Are you talking about, in this study, are you going to be examining, you know, renewables being fully deliverable in an RA sense, or just their energy deliverable, or have you even decided that yet?
I think in the context of what we just were talking about is the energy does not have to be physically delivered to California for it to count toward bucket one under an assumption that the first interconnection is in the balancing area that California is in.
Sorry. You're illustrating exactly my point.
Judy, understood
my question.
That's okay. I think the, clearly for purposes of 33% portfolio, we have a full capacity deliverability requirement. So that is a higher threshold from a planning standpoint in terms of the transmission needs to support that. The question is, for the incremental of going from 33% to 50%, does that additional renewables need to meet that high standard of deliverability under our planning criteria, or can it be an energy-only product that would have a lower threshold of transmission? So we're debating that ourselves, to be candid with you. We've done some studies, as I'm sure you know, in the this year's transmission plan on the energy-only, looking at some portfolios that are a little different than what E3 showed today, but not that different. So we have some ready transmission estimates, or at least conceptually what it would take for the energy only. It'd be a lot harder for us to come up with the full deliverable criteria. So we're kind of leaning towards, for that incremental, relying on an energy only construct, but we'd welcome stakeholders' input on that question.
Okay. Can we see if anybody on the phone?
All right, Jim, I think we have three questions in the queue, so if you can go ahead and open up the phone line, just a reminder to identify yourself before asking your question.
Caller, your line has been unmuted.
Maybe their line is
Hello, this is Adrienne Kendall at the Energy Commission. So, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. So this is Adrienne Kendall, the Energy Commission. So my question relates to the analysis of the disadvantaged communities, and particularly when they were talking about maybe using a propensity score analysis. So what I was wondering is, if they're using a propensity score analysis to try to get rid of some self-selection effect of being in a disadvantaged community when they do their analysis, I would suggest they reconsider that, because you don't want to get rid of that effect. That is, in fact, an does affect the calculation you want. Like if you were doing a medical study of whether a drug worked on women and then your treatment group was only women, you wouldn't want to correct for the fact that they were only women.
Thanks a lot for that insight. That is something that we consider. We're going to be very careful about that, trying to basically look for control versus non-control. This is a technical point, everybody, but that is a risk we're aware of in the estimation process, and we'll be very careful to manage it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, Tim.
Ezra, your line is open. All right, going on to the next line.
Hi, this is Jim Bach at Boat Solar. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, can you repeat your name, please?
Yes, this is Jim Bach with Boat Solar. My question is for Dr. Roland Holst, and it regards the economic modeling. And I wanted to, maybe I missed this, but I wanted to see how you were going to account for the impact on out-of-state resources on industries in California. For instance, if wind from Wyoming is selected into California, that could increase the amount of jobs in California manufacturing wind turbines for GE. Is that something that's being accounted for, and to what extent are you looking at that type of impact on manufacturing jobs from this?
Thank you very much for that point. At the moment, because we're not modeling the economic activities in the other regional economies, that is an effect that would escape our analysis. But we certainly intend to make reference to those possibilities. It is technically outside the geographic scope of the study, but it would be a potential in-state benefit. We will make reference to those opportunities. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any more? That's it for the phone? Yes.
Mark Joseph again. First, I want to thank you for including Scenario 2 in what you're planning to do. It's obviously a big policy question for the legislature, and they will benefit from having good analysis of what that policy choice means. But that just makes the importance of getting the differences between scenario two and scenario three as right as possible. I think this is a question for Arnie. No, I think I saw on one of your slides that in scenario three, there would be about 6,000 megawatts of new generation as opposed to 11,000 megawatts in scenario two. Did I see that right? In California. I thought I would stand up here so I can see you. In terms of resource availability, in scenarios one and two, there's 5,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources available for the model to select. And in scenario three, there's 11,000 megawatts of out-of-state resources available for the model to select. And it selects, from that additional 6,000, it selects 1,500 megawatts each of New Mexico wind and Wyoming wind. So I'm trying to reconcile in my mind what you just said with how the procurement decisions are actually made on a one-by-one incremental basis mm-hmm. by the California LSEs. They don't look at the big picture. They look at the very small picture of the bids that come to them in a solicitation, and they always pick the cheapest. And they don't necessarily look at whether it is the best overall scenario, whether, you know, what the modeling says. They're picking it, you know, one project at a time. And I don't see how, with a one project at a time selection method, they ever pick a California solar project when a solar project in Utah will always be cheaper.
Arnie, could I? I think the key thing to recognize is that to get the transmission to support scenario three approved and built, it has to go through the centralized planning here at the ISO, where we're going to take our cues from the Public Utilities Commission on directionally where do they want to go with the renewable procurement. So that transmission has a long lead time, so it's going to get approved before these PPAs get executed. The utilities are going to want some direction as a matter of state policy on where they should be looking to meet that 50%. That's part of what the READY initiative is. It's part of what the integrated resource planning work that the PUC is doing. So we would anticipate under scenario three that we would get policy direction well in advance of the PPAs on if they want to support this WECC-wide diverse portfolio, that here are the portfolios we're looking at, and you ISO tell us what it's going to take for transmission to support. So that's why we view it as a matter of state policy on whether scenario three gets pursued or not, not to the, you know, simply to the procurement activities of the utilities.
But the key difference between scenario two and scenario three is you don't have to have transmission to get Utah generation to California load. So I don't know why there's a transmission process that will say, oh, but don't ignore that cheap solar in Utah and go ahead and pick the more expensive solar in Central Valley.
Well, the big difference in scenario two and three is you're trading off. In scenario three, you're accessing the high-quality wind resources in Wyoming and New Mexico, and you're backing off primarily California solar in that trade-off. But to access those high-quality wind resources, you're going to need transmission. We're going to have state policy direction that they want us to pursue that transmission, and that's where the policy is going to lead the procurement.
Maybe I could add something here, too, which is that I don't think it's true that the utilities only pick the least cost resources in their solicitations. There's also such a thing as best fit, right? And I know that they go through a portfolio analysis and they look at what the profile is of the resource that they're selecting. They match that up against the prevailing market prices or perhaps against a production simulation model similar to the one that we use in results. Do that valuation. So it's not least cost, it's really least net cost, which includes the value of the capacity that you get, includes the value of the energy that you get. So there is that valuation component, and to the extent that you're displacing more expensive fossil generation in California than you are in these other regions, to the extent that there are losses and other factors that play into it, you know, it's not necessarily true that you just take the least cost, and if it's in Utah, then you build 10,000 megawatts in Utah.
It's certainly true that they look at any capacity value that a project brings and any transmission cost that it brings. But the idea that they're doing production cost modeling before they make their choices, I wish it were true, but it's not. That is not how they make their decisions. And I hope you're not assuming that they're going to go through some kind of modeling exercise like that to make those decisions, because that's not reality.
Well, I guess we certainly are hoping that as the portfolio impacts become more and more important, as the saturation effects become more and more important, that the utilities and their bid evaluation processes will recognize that reality, because we'll be seeing it in market prices going forward. Right now it's kind of theoretical. We're looking forward to a grid 10 years from now that's very different than that we know now, right? I'm pretty confident that when we start seeing real market prices, you know, being driven down by excess solar or negative market prices, that the utilities will be smart enough to figure that out and put that into their stuff.
We're not relying on that. We're relying on the coordinated planning process we've had for the last 6 years. How do we identify the transmission to support the preferred portfolio direction that the PUC wants to go? And to me, that will happen well in advance of procurement decisions. The utilities will look to get direction from things like READY, from the integrated resource planning. So I think this is well within the control of the state in terms of where we go directionally on this regional procurement.
I also want to add that those that do have specific suggestions or suggestions to the portfolio makeup, the more specific your comments are to us, the more we can consider those suggestions. So I just if you could take that into consideration in your comments. I want to make sure we have opportunities for others to comment. Yes.
Yeah, hi, this is, this is Sandeep Arora with LS Power. Thanks for the great meeting today, good discussion. LS Power is an independent power producer, gen developer, and transmission developer as well. So basically, I'm just trying to understand the new transmission, you know, assumptions that will be used. I understand we've got to run through the process, the coordinated planning process. READY has to get involved, and interregional play might come into the mix as well. But as part of the scope of this particular study, my questions are mainly trying to understand, I guess I want to understand a little bit better how would you model for your studies, which are trying to bring for scenario 3, 1,500 megawatt from Wyoming wind, 1,500 megawatt from New Mexico. What exact transmission projects are you going to model? Is it going to be a generic? You're going to use a generic dollar per mile assumption for those projects? And basically, as you're going and making these choices, are you going to look at any additional benefits that these transmission options would provide? Essentially, I mean, when you build a new transmission line that connects Wyoming to California, helps you deliver additional 1,500, maybe up to 3,000 megawatt of renewables from Wyoming to California, it's got to have these additional reliability benefits. And it's, you know, WEC operates in a big loop flow fashion. You throw in another big 500 kV line into the mix, and that helps address a lot of your WEC northeast-southeast separation type issues, congestion on COI, congestion on Path 26, several additional benefits. We do see those for new transmission. Are those going to be accounted at this stage in the study process?
What a great question. That is a really good question. I think if we were to do the perfect study, we would love to incorporate all of those benefits. I think we are limited in the amount that we can quantify. So to answer your question as specifically as I can, right now, we're not anticipating that we will have specific transmission projects or lines lined up to say those are the lines to deliver that wind from New Mexico. We don't anticipate to use this study to do the transmission analyses that's necessary to accompany those resources. But to your point, there are significant other benefits potentially associated with building out the grid in the West to better integrate renewable resources, to better improve reliability, to increase flexibility, to improve competition in the West, et cetera. I mean, I think Hannes and I have talked about this in other form about the value of improving the grid or having a more robust grid.
I don't think we're going to be able to incorporate all of those benefits and quantify them in this study, but I think we will be commenting on them and discussing them. If we cannot quantify a certain area, we will be discussing in a qualitative way. At least that's our anticipation at this moment.
Thank you. Just a quick follow-up. So at this stage, as stakeholders, would we have an opportunity to, say, provide inputs to what's a good dollar per megawatt per mile cost assumption for that new transmission upgrade?
Yes, we would very much welcome that.
Okay, thank you.
The gentleman in yellow.
Thanks. Matt Friedman with TURN. I just want to reinforce some of the concerns that were raised about the potential disconnect between assumptions that are made in the study process and the reality of California procurement practices, the current market realities, and what we're likely to see as a result. For example, the model has to look at California's RPS requirements under the business as usual scenario that assumes utilities would actually go out there and buy what's called bucket 2 and 3. There are allowances in the current program, and in order to understand how that might play out, you need to really look at the renewable net short positions of the load-serving entities in California through 2030. The PacifiCorp study that folks have relied on here extensively included the unrealistic assumption that there would be no procurement of bucket 2 and 3 resources post-2020 by any load-serving entities. That's not a very useful assumption to take forward. The investor-owned utilities, who have procured very little of bucket 2 and 3 to date, have a huge allocation, tons of headroom available to them through 2030. They could use that headroom under business as usual to buy all of the low-cost, high-quality Wyoming wind that's included in the study. You've also got lots of other load-serving entities that have a disproportionately larger appetite because, as everybody knows, the IOUs are over-procured right now structurally relative to their targets. So you've got to look at the electric service providers. You have to look at the CCAs. You have to look at the small POUs, all of whom will have a lot of appetite but a lot of opportunity to buy bucket 2 and 3. You can't ignore that. You may end up getting the same number of megawatts from Wyoming under business as usual if you just make that simple assumption. The other thing I would point out is it was raised earlier that you need to align the study assumptions regarding solar costs and other technology costs with real market realities. I mean, all of the numbers that were used in the presentation previously about current solar costs are way high relative to the current market. So if you're way off based on current market prices, it's hard to project forward and have a robust set of assumptions. And then finally, there's a lot of existing renewable energy out there in the West today. If you expand the footprint of bucket 1 and you say anything that's interconnected to the larger balancing authority or can deliver directly into that larger footprint is automatically bucket 1, you have to look at what is out there today that's surplus that can sell into that broader market. You may not actually end up getting new generation being developed in Wyoming. You may get folks reselling existing surpluses. You may end up with BC Hydro selling into the larger market because they can directly deliver their wind. You may have Utah QFs participating. What we've seen in the procurement space is that load-serving entities will do the cheapest, easiest deals they can find, and the cheapest and easiest deals are often with existing resources, not new ones. So if you ignore that possibility, then you have ignored the reality of how these market actors typically behave. And then finally, the last thing I would suggest is there's this talk about the need to link new transmission upgrades to some sort of procurement assumptions that are linked to Wyoming wind. I mean, if this is about the PacifiCorp Gateway projects, why don't you just assume they're going to get built regardless? PacifiCorp certainly seems to think so. And if those are going to go into the system and those costs are going to get put in, you should assume that regardless of what kind of scenarios you're looking at, business as usual scenario 3.
I had just a follow-up comment. I appreciate the comments, but what would really be helpful is if you could provide some supporting data for some of your statements. So if we're grossly overstating the cost of solar. Is there a study or a data source you could point us to understand that? The portfolios that E3 presented assumed a certain amount of headroom with regard to RECs and renewables accessible with existing transmission. I think around 4,000 megawatts or thereabouts, 5,000 megawatts. If you believe it's more than that, is there something you can show that could support that? So at the end of the day, if we're going to make stronger assumptions in these areas, we need to back it up with some sort of a reference. So we'd appreciate anything you could provide on that.
Sure. We'll provide comments, but also we can't do our own study. That's the functional equivalent of the study that all of the multiple consulting firms represented here are doing. So we will provide direction, and we can cite to some sources. But I don't think it's a fair burden to place on small interveners to say we're supposed to come up with our own, complementary studies.
I was asking for sources and references to some of your claims.
Sure.
Okay. Yeah, I think in general, again, the more specific you can be about the direction, the numbers that you feel that are better than the assumptions that we're putting out there, and the support for that, I think we would very much welcome that. I would just want to say that we put a lot of thought into the portfolios that Arnie had presented and the assumptions. A lot of thought capturing what we thought would be a range of plausible futures. And if you think that there is some other scenario out there that we absolutely need to look at and we're not looking at, I think the more specific you can be in your suggestion, the better we can react. We're not suggesting to put the burden on you, but we want to make sure we're responsive to your comments. Yes.
Yeah. Following up on that a little bit, we can argue all day long about what the cost of solar is today, even, but here we are talking about what it's going to be 15, 20 years from now. And, there's a strong possibility we're all wrong. And so I'm not sure that we want to spend too much time worrying about the specific answer, but making sure that we have a range of plausible things built in. And the problem we've got here is that you're taking this resolve model and you have a single set of numbers, which is RPS calculator version 6.1 to be okay. Well, if we use 6.0 or if we use 6.2, we'd get a different set of assumptions. So is there some way when we go through and build these analyses that we can at least sort of post-process these results with ranges in gas prices and renewable things, or the performance of Wyoming wind? I mean, you're talking about 42-43%. I submit that's probably 20% too low, for what we're going to do. So there's all these ranges, but we have to capture the ranges and not lose them all with just this set of assumptions, no matter what they are, whether you pick Matt's or mine or whatever.
Yeah, Jim, I think that's a great comment. And, I think part of what we need to, it kind of goes back to my opening comments about, we're not trying to develop the optimal portfolios for meeting the 50%. That's a state policy issue that's going to run its course over the next couple of years. So the real question is, how much does it matter for purposes of assessing the benefits of a regional market? And what are the sensitivities around that? If it's 6,000 megawatts of in-state solar versus 7,000 megawatts of in-state solar, does it really change the benefit proposition of a regional market? So I just think we have to be cognizant of what we're trying to assess in this analysis. And I'm not saying the portfolios are irrelevant to that, but I think we have to be careful that we don't get too focused on trying to solve the portfolio question when some of the things we're arguing about maybe...
Well, then why did we do it this way? I mean, we spend all the time on designing the optimum portfolios. I agree with you totally, but why don't we just make sure that we pick the range of portfolios that represents sort of a view of the possible futures and see what that range of portfolios looks like, with and without regional organization, and not get hung up on which is optimum, because I don't think Yeah. You know, people are going to take the results here. And they're going to not compare them scenario 2 to scenario 3, but they're going to compare it to some baseline at 33%, and they're going to say rates are going to go up this or think these things are going to happen. And so we need to be careful that we don't, you know, that we don't over-specify some of these details and miss the range of possible futures that we want to look at as to whether benefits of regional cooperation are.
Yeah, and, you know, I think the desire to rely on the resolve model to come up with these is to have some sort of a transparent, objective basis for how we arrived at these, as opposed to it being my opinion or Arnie's opinion or somebody's opinion of what's a reasonable range.
Well, your opinion's a lot more transparent than resolve.
Well, I don't know. I would beg to differ with that. I think we've tried to be very transparent today on what the cost assumptions were that went into that and how the calculator makes those decisions. So, at any rate, I certainly take your point that, you know, testing this over a range of scenarios may make sense. We've put forward a range of portfolios for you to consider if you think there are other permutations we ought to look at. We'll be open to doing that.
We have 5 minutes. I want to make sure we get the comments that haven't been stated already. A gentleman back there.
Yes, hi. This is Chris DeJet, representing eMotorworks. So electric vehicles are one of the biggest sources of load growth, and they're also one of the biggest sources of economic benefit, petroleum, you know, switch to electrification. Right now it's possible to dispatch those loads. And I'm wondering, did you assume that the loads could be dispatchable, the vehicle charging loads? And if not, what kind of benefits or changes on the portfolio would you expect from being able to dispatch those loads?
Yeah, so in the resolve model, we just have confirmed that by 2030 we have we're assuming 6.8 million electric vehicles on the road in California. So we have, you know, in keeping with the governor's goals, you know, modeled a pretty significant increase in the amount of electric vehicles. And we haven't made those dispatchable within the model, but as I said earlier, we've given them a charging profile that's sort of in retrospect very favorable relative to the type of, to the grid that we're seeing. So in my opinion, that's, you know, that's a, it's a simplification, but it's one that gets you 90% of the benefits with only 10% of the complicated code. So I don't think there's a lot to gain by modeling them in dispatchable in real time.
Yes. Tony Braun, California Municipal Utilities Association. So, Keith, we're going to do our darndest to put together robust comments by the 19th. How you will do justice to all that input, even given the consulting juggernaut you've assembled, is unclear to me, given the timelines we're working with here. And I guess we'll just watch to see how that plays out, but I think the task is Herculean and the consequences are monumental. One of our takeaways from the first build-out of transmission is that while it certainly enabled the deliverability of renewables, the benefits, the practical benefits that flowed weren't commensurate with the cost allocation. So we are talking about these large, broad swaths of benefits. But if history is any guide, the publicly owned utilities in your balancing authority area are not likely to be huge off-takers of massive mega 100 megawatts of wind facilities in disparate states. And yet we're faced with a real possibility of paying for a significant percentage of those. So as we're walking through these, let's be cognizant of the fact that, you know, these broad statements of benefits don't apply equally, and we're certainly watching with a close eye whether or not these policy initiatives are actually holding out any realistic benefit for the POUs within your balancing authority.
Okay. Yes, Antonio.
Just wanted to thank the ISOP for having the meeting and giving us the opportunity to comment. I wrote a couple of things that I'm going to work on and providing comments or suggestions related to reliability and allocation of costs among the areas. I do have two more additional comments right now. One, with respect to the load growth and other assumptions that are do not appear to be consistent with SB 350. For example, just piggybacking on Mike's, the load growth, we don't see the load growth given the increase in distributed generation and, more importantly, the doubling of the energy efficiency that is embedded in SB 350. So having those assumptions, I think, would be very useful, maybe aiming to having an emission target that is consistent with the 40% reduction by 2030 would make sense. The other comment that I had, and I just don't have a particular proposal, but it seems to me that a lot of the benefits that come from the RPS purchase, cost reduction, are a function of the spread between the cost and the market price of renewable energy. And I don't know if you have a way of addressing that in terms of how that is spread is going to be divided or who's going to capture what portion. I don't know if that makes any sense. So that may be something to consider in the analysis.
Okay. Do we
want to
answer?
Yeah, thanks for the comment. I don't have a way of I've been doing this for a long time, and that issue always comes up, and I recognize that it's real, and I wish we had developed a nice, easy way to forecast what the renewable energy market price, clearing price would be, rather than building it up from bottom up based on cost. But I've never come up with a good way to do that, and never have heard one suggested to me.
Okay. Is there a new comment? Are there others on the phone? Because we are at the end of our comment period. I just want to make sure everybody has an opportunity to go ahead. Okay.
I think it's a yes-no question. We've heard a lot about how Resolve works to optimize, and clearly the balance between solar and non-solar is driven by the level of overgeneration that would occur with one mix or another mix. Which means it ought to be really important to think about ways to affect the amount of overgeneration. There was a question a minute ago about dispatchable dispatchable electric car charging as one way to mitigate potential overgeneration. Are you doing any modeling of load shape changing through load management, through tariffs?
I think the one mitigating factor is storage. But are there others you
want to
highlight?
Yeah, so the model does have the ability to pick storage, and definitely in some scenarios we've seen it pick either batteries or pump storage, depending on what you assume about the cost. We do have in there, in the load shapes, the effect of time of use rates. So that's one of the concrete steps that the state has already taken to address issues like this. We don't have in there flexible load, and we have in there existing demand response programs and continuations of those. What we don't have in there is new advanced demand response or flexible load programs. And really the simple issue there is we just don't have a good sense of what the supply curve looks like for those type of resources. We think they're probably not free. Some of them may actually involve storage of one form or another, whether it's battery storage or thermal energy storage, ice bare, preheating, pre-cooling. So these things aren't necessarily free. And there are ongoing studies that we're actually involved with through LDNL and the PUC to try to flesh out that supply curve and understand just how big that resource is and what it costs to make these changes to loads. But we just don't have good data now on what that potential looks like and what its cost is.
I would just reiterate, too, that a lot of the demand programs that we're seeing show up or at least be talked about from a policy standpoint involve behind-the-meter resources like storage, and they do have cost curves for all sorts of battery storage in their Resolve model that they use, which is kind of an indirect way of getting at a proxy cost of some of these automated demand programs.
Okay, I'm told that there are no other questions or people lined up on the phone, so given that it is 4:30, where we are. We really appreciate all of the comments that we received today. You will also have a chance to put them in writing, and we hope you do. And we will try our best to incorporate and answer your comments and to consider those very important suggestions in our study. I'm not going to read this slide, but this is a slide about where we are. We are currently setting up the analyses, both the renewable expansion or the renewable integration analyses, as well as the production cost analyses, low diversity analyses, and working with Aspen Bear on the environmental and economic impact. Graphically, this is where we are today. We look forward to having your comments in. We definitely can tell by this, just even today's dialogue, where the emphases are, and I think that will give us some fruit for thought and to hopefully improve our analytical approaches and assumptions. And here, your comments are due on the 19th. There's a template that's provided specifically asking for your feedback on very specific questions. There are, I don't know, 20 of them or something like that. But certainly there are also areas where you can provide your own comments on top of that. We are hoping to have a stakeholder meeting to discuss draft study results on April 14th and 15th. That's the target date at this moment. And to have a joint agency workshop target with June 6th. With that, I just want to thank you again for participating. And, you know, some of you have come a long way to be here and to provide us very valuable input, and all the people on the phone. Thank you very much for participating. Thank you.
And just quickly before I let everybody go, we do have some sign-up sheets as you entered the room. If you are interested in receiving market notices about regional integration, we'd be happy to take your information and automatically enroll you. Also, just to let you know, we do have biweekly calls on regional integration, and we encourage you to participate. The information for those, if they're the first and third Tuesday of every month, which really isn't biweekly, but they are the first and third Tuesday of every month. The information for how to participate is on our public calendar. Our next call is February 16th, and we do cover SB 350 during those calls. So.
Those discussions every 2 weeks are on the governance, not on the studies, though, correct?
It's SB 350. It's SB 350 regional governance. We also cover the stakeholder initiatives that are active.
Okay.
This is Stacey Crowley, just to clarify. Those calls, the first and third Tuesdays of the month, are to talk about all things regional. So it does include the stakeholder processes that we're going through, and it's just meant to be kind of an overview of all the things that happen are happening at the regional level.